everybody. This is Armand DeMel with you with The Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Everything I used to think, I changed my mind. Hey, you know, here's one. Money can't buy you happiness. That's what they say, huh? People's emotional well-being, happiness, increases along with their income, it seems. So it seems that it's not true. The researchers from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, they found that people who earn gradually up from their average levels to $75,000 a year get happier with the more money they have. And that over $75,000, it doesn't make a difference. More than $75,000 doesn't make you any happier. $100,000 doesn't make you happier than $75,000. But $75,000 makes you happier than $74,000 and $73,000 and $72,000. It just seems like people do have a comfort level. So we never knew we could measure it. You know, it's like any day now we're going to find that you can buy love. The general sense of well-being grew as their earnings grew. Interesting, isn't it? Who knew? Well, let's talk about Santiago. Santiago's a baby just born in this world. That's his name. Now, why am I want to talk about him? Because you look at him and you wonder, what chance does an infant have on this planet today? If a kid's born, is he going to be okay? Every mother has gone through this with their children. Is my child okay? If you're a parent, a father, but not as much as the mother, you have this concern. How is my kid going to be okay? It's my job to protect them, make them okay. Can a great parent, a parent who is loving, well, I don't know, what would you call, I'm with me, Stephanie Dombra. Stephanie, what's a great nurturing parent? Somebody who is what?
Well, I think somebody who is available and capable of focusing and being affectionate and loving and giving guidance and direction and setting limits, offering stimulation, making sure they're not harmed, not abusing them. I mean, that's great. I mean, people could be good enough parents and offer many of those things, or they could be okay parents and just make sure the kids aren't getting into danger or being hurt.
But that's an incredible criteria you laid out there. Yes. So that's the loving parent, the nurturing parent. You're not abusing the child. You're not pushing the child into roles that they don't belong into in the first place. You're watching out for them. You're stimulating them in some way. You don't keep them watching TV. You're an attentive parent. But some recent research has indicated that no matter how good a parent you are, your kid's not going to make it. The child's not going to make it on the planet. They may live, but they may not be happy or successful. A patient will scream, I don't know what I did wrong with my daughter. Why is my daughter turning out that way? An intelligent, articulate woman in her early 40s who came in for depression and anxiety. She discussed her stresses, and it was clear her teenage son has been front and center for many years. When you have a teenage son who is disturbed, it just drives you crazy. You try everything you can. When he was growing up, she explained, he fought frequently with other children. He had few close friends, had a reputation for being mean. She always hoped he would change, but now he was almost 17. And she had this horrible sinking feeling. What must it be like to have a parent who has a child, a teenage child, who is bent. Their mind is bent. They hurt other people. They do things to themselves. He's unkind, he's unsympathetic to people, she said. He was rude and defiant at home and often verbally abusive to family members. So along the way, she had him evaluated by psychiatrists, and they said they saw no evidence of any learning disability, but she kept seeing this problem over and over again. So here it seems they did not fare as well as did their son under psychiatric scrutiny. One therapist noted they were not entirely coexistent with their son. They weren't consistent with their son. That one of the ways that they tried to point up, it's the way you bring up your child that makes the child have this reaction. This conflict is called the nature versus nurture conflict. Nature versus nurture. Nature meaning, what is your child born with? What's their chemistry when they come into the planet? And are they born mentally mixed up, scrambled, disabled? Is it a matter of their hormones, their genes, their neurochemistry? What is a kid born with that gives the child, makes the child just dysfunctional, nasty, can't learn, any number of things? And is there anything a loving parent could do about it? We in the psychological profession like to believe that it is the nurturance that makes the difference. We like to believe that that's what, once you have that child, no matter how bent the child is, the child will be okay. Do you ever get a kitten who is cute as you can imagine but was spooked as a child? A kitten who is like, you know, really nervous kitten. You take that kitten and you give that kitten enough loving, and the kitten could turn into a really, pardon the expression, pussycat, right? But there are some cats that never get over whatever it is they were born with. Some children are like that. And it's a very, very difficult thing to face, because a lot of those children grow up to be adults the same way. Many adults will say, I can't blame my parents, because you really can't. The parents did their thing. If a child is disturbed, odds are that the parents were not altogether sane and healthy and so on and so forth. The odds are that something went wrong with the child's nurturance, but it's not an absolute. It's not 100%. What are the things that could go wrong with a child on the nature part? What could a child be born with that makes a child just be out of sorts, Steph?
Well, nowadays we're able to see that there's these variants, these genetic variants that are related to what we often talk about, these neurotransmitter productions and deficiencies. And so an example would be a child that is born with social anxiety because of that genetic variant.
What is social anxiety?
It's that idea that they're very nervous to go out and have to perform or interact with people in public. And so they feel anxious if they have to leave for school in the morning or leave their mother. And so, yes, there's those kind of traits, we call them, that are there. And of course, maybe the mother has the same trait. And so it's very hard to determine, did they just get it handed down genetically, or did the mother and the father do something? And what's kind of ironic is that although some parents are, like you said, good enough parents, ultimately you can't really hold anybody responsible, but it's the two parents' genes that also go into it, and it's like a deck of cards. You shuffle it every time, and it's different. So two parents can have four kids, let's say, and each time there's going to be a different kind of an expression of their, you know, gene pool mixing together.
It's their gene pool that will lead to their hormone pill, their chemical pool, which will lead to how much sugar they have, whether they'll have enough insulin in their bodies, which will lead to their nervousness, and there's a genetic, basically laid out pattern for each child. We used to call it jelly beans. Hmm. When I was a kid, you used to have jelly beans, and we would say, okay, if you have black jelly beans, that means you're depressed. If you have white jelly beans, it means you're spiritual. If you have red jelly beans, it means you're angry. And here's the way we saw it, we meaning I. I saw that when you were born, there's a great stoker up in the sky. And there's a bag, and then you come along, and they say, okay, give him some white jelly beans and some black jelly beans and some red jelly beans. Give him some of those green jelly beans for envy, you know, some of those purple ones for inner peace. And we give you all these different jelly beans, but every now and then, the stoker, the one who's allocating the jelly beans, is not looking properly, and they give you too many red jelly beans, and you're too angry. Too many black jelly beans, and you're too depressed. Too many white ones, and you're too spiritual. And so what we used to talk about, what I would always refer to as their portion of jelly beans, you know, the jelly bean portions go off. Well, I think people are like that. You're born genetically, and you could have different aspects of yourself that are just genetically inherited. Now, gene variants, which is very important. Do you know gene variants? He lives uptown. Gene variants. Tell me, Steph, isn't there a gene variant that if expressed in a male is different than a female?
Well, here the example is that what I was just describing. Let's say two different people in different families and in different communities have this gene variant that's related to this serotonin.
Can we describe
deficiency.
What a gene variant is?
Well, I'm not very good at those kind of things, but I know that we have traits. Dominant and recessive traits, and there's I don't know how many different genes in our, you know, in our sperm and egg production. I can't really express that, Armand, but I can understand to some extent that we inherit these things from our parents, and so they're going to be expressed if they're really, let's say, dominant.
Okay, so let me try to get this picture. There's a DNA that we're born with. The DNA is kind of a map, but it is a physical map. And in our DNA, we have different genes. And these different genes can be one shape or another shape, but they're usually the gene for body type, the gene for chest type, the gene for eyesight. There are different genes. In some people, a gene variant means that it's not the normal gene, but it's an alter gene. It's a longer gene or a shorter gene. And that would lead to either having attributes or deficiencies other than normal. That's a gene variant. Now, you could have a gene variant that works great for one person, but then it doesn't for another. Now, let's talk about this man-woman gene variant.
Okay, well, I'm not so sure if maybe on some level, it could work great. But using this example that we were saying about social anxiety, one female, let's say, could be born into a stable, emotionally loving family and still develop social anxiety because she has this specific gene variant that's related to serotonin production or deficiency. She develops social anxiety, but with the same gene variant in a male in a different community that is impoverished, it's going to be expressed in criminality and violence and aggression. So it could be expressed differently depending on the environment and the family and the upbringing. And that's what we're learning about how the nature versus nurture interacts with each other.
Well, I don't mean to let bad parents off the hook because there are bad parents out there. Sadly, there are too many of them. What's a bad parent? Well, the opposite of what Stephanie talked about. You know, what would a bad parent be, Steph?
Well, again, neglecting their kids.
What do you mean neglecting?
Neglecting meaning, it could be very benign, meaning let's just put you in front of the TV for 6 hours, or you could leave the child and not have anybody there to protect them, to be there, to babysit them, to feed them, to give them good food, to make sure you go to the doctors, to make sure they get to school and they're doing work. you could physically abuse them. You could sexually abuse them. That's the category, I think, of bad parenting, we'll call it.
And there's more. There's lack of stimulation.
Well, yes. Okay. There's extreme hard stuff, and then there's this, like, the soft, benign neglect, where you're not trying to hurt the child, but you're not giving them, like, a rich life.
And then there are the different psychological things that you do with a child, where a mother marries her son, and she holds up her son against her husband, and you form triangles. That's damaging. That's the kind of thing that means that is equally toxic, and many parents I know have it. But your child could also be born with gene variants that there's nothing you could do about. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know what good it does. I've seen so many parents break down in tears in my office saying, what did I do to create this? And in some cases, it's a worthy question, because they are perpetuating something. But in other cases, you got to get past it. You got to get past it and say, okay, we're at this point now where the condition is the condition itself. And we're going to talk about some of the varieties of this. In fact, Steph, let's talk about the psychopath.
Well, there was an interesting story about a man who actually was a neuroscientist, and he studied the biological basis of behavior, and he was interested in the minds of psychopaths versus normal people.
Now, what's a psychopath?
A psychopath is a person who basically has no remorse and does things that are probably pretty hurtful or criminal, and do not feel that there should be any consequences. So they could be pretty extreme. And
so a psychopath is somebody who hurts people in general and doesn't care, you know, and says, well, you know, so what? They don't feel the remorse. Nothing controls them. No conscience.
So the story was that this particular neuroscientist decided to check out his own brain and his genetic variants. And it turns out he came from a family of criminal minds and murderers, including Lizzie Borden, the famous Lizzie Borden. And it turns out after he did this brain scan, he himself had that same genetic variant. And then, you know, he was trying to understand, wait a minute, if I have the same thing where the family members were, you know, not able to control their behaviors and had rage and all sorts of things. He was carrying the gene, but for some reason, in addition to the gene that would cause someone to be psychopathic, he also didn't have a gene that helped him to calm down his aggression, which is a, you know, part of the serotonin gene variant that calms us down. But for some other people, if we don't have it, it makes us aggressive. So he had two of these variants. But in reality, he wasn't a killer, and he did not express what was given to him. And that really points to the fact that we can't write off people, that you're damaged goods just because you have these variants. It has to do with your environment, how you direct it. And again, I really like the image of a deck being shuffled, cards being shuffled. You cannot know exactly how you're going to express things when you're, you know, I mean, you can see it as a child, and he probably also was, you know, a curious mind that wasn't going astray. So it's there, but it, you know, fortunately for him, he learned that, you know, he's not doomed.
Well, you know, we marvel at the resilient child who survives the most toxic parents and home environment. We look at kids who come up out of the slums or out of the dumps or out of really intense parenting and go on to a life of success. And we marvel at this. We say, wow, where did you get that spirit? Yet the converse, the notion that some people might be the bad seeds of decent parents, is hard to take. It goes against the grain because it seems like such a grim and pessimistic judgment. And it violates a prevailing social belief that people have a nearly limitless power for change and self-improvement. And not everybody does. After all, we are the culture of Baby Einstein, the video product that promised and spectacularly failed to make geniuses of all our infants. You know the Baby Einsteins? Not everyone is going to turn out to be brilliant any more than everyone will turn out nice and loving. And that is not necessarily because of parental failure or an impoverished environment. It is because everyday character traits, like all human behavior, are hardwired and genetic components that cannot be molded even by the best environment. So what we're learning, my friends, is that more or less certain people just aren't going to change. And one of the biggest problems you have in relationships is people hoping the other person's going to change. We are somewhat hardwired. So what is nature versus nurture? It's like the oldest issue in psychology. The debate centers around the relative contributions of genetic inheritance versus the environmental factors. Plato, Descartes, they both suggested that certain things are inborn, that they exist regardless of the environmental influence. John Locke believed in what is known as the tabula rasa, which suggests that the mind begins as a blank slate. He said it's a blank slate, and then anything you do to the child is what appears. According to that notion, everything we are and all of our knowledge is determined by our experience. That is the nurture experience. When a person achieves tremendous academic success, they did so because they're genetically predisposed to be successful or is the result of an enriched environment. Which one made it happen? Today, the majority of experts believe that behavior and development are influenced by nature and nurture. And just let's look at sports achievement. Let's look at the achievement on a sports level, right? The nurture versus nature.
Well, I think, Armand, that they're trying to determine, is there like a speed gene, for instance, yeah, in runners? Why are some people and some parts from different parts of the world, why are they so much faster? You know, aside from all this doping issue that, you know, keeps coming up. There has to be some part of a genetic trait. You know, as much as you could practice anything, I tend to agree that it's like 10%, like the creativity statement that often is said, something about somebody famous, maybe it was even Einstein, perspiration is 90%. So there's all this effort that has to go in, and you get like 10% of your genes working for you, and then the rest of it you have to follow through with hard work. But even now, they're saying, well, how do you even get motivated to do the hard work? You could have the talent, but then isn't even wanting to do it also potentially genetic? Because how many stories have you heard? I hear it where you can have a talented child, but no matter how much you force the child to practice or do an exercise or go out for the team, if they're not motivated, they're not going to do it. And a parent can't absolutely force a child to do something. I mean, some parents do it, but then you have to have an obedient child. And to me, an obedient child has still got some kind of genetic trait operating.
So if you have this, Steph, the child who is not congruent with its environment, who feels alienated, sometimes we just have to figure out, you know, well, you are different. We keep telling the children they're not different, but sometimes they are. And I wonder if it's which is to the child's advantage. If you take a child who's hypersensitive, and this young, let's say, female child or woman child keeps crying all the time and says, oh, I can't stand that I saw a cockroach being killed, and it just hurts me so much. What's to our advantage to say to the child, they told me a cockroach? To say to the child, yes, I understand. in all truth, everybody should cry when a cockroach dies because a cockroach represents all of us and all of nature? Or is it to say to a child, yes, you are more sensitive to that than most people are. Yes, you will feel that more than others do. Other people don't have that level of sensitivity of yours. Which would nurture the child the most? To tell the child they're wrong for being the way they are? For tell the child that they are the way they are? Or to tell the child that they are, you know, extremely great because of the way they are? And it seems what we do as therapists, our role when we get them after childhood, is to tell them, yes, you are that way. This is your reality. Yes, you are more sensitive. Yes, you are more needy. Yes, you are more creative. Yes, that beautiful brain of yours does take things a little more seriously than other people do. And to remind people over and over again that they have, their character may be their own, but it's not their fault. I think that's where we take people. That's where I think therapists take people. What do you do when you have someone bipolarity? You know, Stephanie, when you have somebody who's just reacting so seriously, don't you talk to them? Don't you remind them over and over again, this is your nature?
Well, I certainly do. But in the case of really extreme mental illness, Armand, that becomes a whole nother kind of can of worms, so to speak. Because then you're dealing with like the profound denial that's in some mental illnesses, and you cannot penetrate sometimes. And so without the environmental things to help them, meaning, you know, some cases where medication is absolutely essential for them to function, then you're at a loss.
You are. But, you know, there is a thing like, let's say, an extreme paranoia. Right? When a person's very paranoid and they say they were talking about me and I know they were talking about me, my response is I fully understand how you perceive that because you're more sensitive to that than most other people are. I can't tell you if they were talking about you or not, but I know you're listening for that. I know that your ears are sharper. And even with the most disturbed cases, you could deliver it in such a way that makes a person feel like you're not calling them crazy, but you're not agreeing with them either, which is what I think our job is. And I think that's what the job of most parents are as well, to somehow validate a child's existence without trying to take it away, smother it, smash it, you know what I mean? That's what gets really difficult. So we're going to take your calls about this a little later after our break. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. We're with you Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 1 p.m. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, a little music, and when we come back, we will continue with this and take your phone calls. Thank you. Chen Chen. Sonora del Sol. And nice music. 212-209-2900. Listen, you got your green eyes from your mother, your freckles from your father, but where did you get that thrill-seeking personality of yours? Or your talent for singing? Where did that come from? Did you learn those from your parents? Or was it predetermined by your genes? While it's clear that physical characteristics are hereditary, the genetic waters get a bit murky when it comes to an individual's behavior, intelligence, and personality. Ultimately, the old argument of nurture versus nurture has never really, nature versus nurture, has never really been won. We are learning that there is more nature to it than we thought. On the nature theory, what we keep looking for is the search for behavioral genes, right? Many fear that genetic arguments might be used to excuse criminal acts or justify divorce or something like that. And they get worried about it. They're afraid to do the research. They're going to say, you know, it's going to be somebody's defense. They're going to say, I murdered him, but it's in my genes. The most debated issue has to do with sexual preferences. Is there a gay gene? And they have a lot of argument about even determining that in the first place. If genetics don't play a part, then fraternal twins reared under the same conditions would be alike, regardless of differences in their genes, right? But while studies show that they do more closely resemble each other than do non-twin brothers and sisters, they also show some striking similarities when reared apart, as in similar studies done with identical twins. The nurture theory, John Watson, took Young, said that, give me a dozen healthy infants, well-formed, and my own specified world to bring them up in, and I guarantee to take anyone at random and train them to become any type of specialist I might select. John Watson said, you can make anybody happy, healthy, and functional. Skinner, B.F. Skinner, he used to believe that he could produce pigeons. He did. Pigeons who could dance, do figure eights. Pigeons who played tennis. Yep. So what is it? Which one has determined your way of being? And you kind of know it. 212-209-2900. Let's take one of your calls. This is Armand DeMille with Stephanie Dombra. Hi, you're on the air. Hello there. We'll be getting that through in a minute, Ken. 212-209-2900. We have somebody on the air. We just got to make this one little connection to make it happen.
Everything is fine from this end.
Everything is fine from this end, Ken. So we just don't hear the caller.
I can hear the caller from this end.
Yeah, but we can't hear it over here. So there's a button that's got to be pushed somewhere. Yeah. Well, we're not going to be able to do it today, I imagine.
Oh, boy. I'm resetting everything and...
Yeah, it's going to be one little button, Ken. It's going to be something like an audition button or something. Okay, there's a person there. But we
Armin?
Yes, there you are.
Armin, this is Joe. How are you?
I didn't even do anything.
Hello there, Joe.
I'm a twin, actually, Armin.
Uh-huh.
I'm a twin.
And how does that feel?
Oh, special. Special. Actually, it mixed. It's because I've never had my own birthday. It's always, quite often, it's always been, you know, always shared with my brother. So it was just very interesting in that regard through the years. And there's a specialness also, the reaction that people are when they meet us. You know, we look very much alike. And it is interesting.
How are your characters different?
I'm probably a lot more assertive. We're both Tauruses, naturally. I'm probably a little more assertive than he is.
Are you the older or the younger?
I am the older.
Yep, that's what they say.
Well, and I came home.
When we say older, we're talking about what age, what time difference?
18 minutes.
18 minutes apart.
Yeah, and he stayed in the hospital for about a month where I came home.
Because he was undersized?
That's correct. But Armin, I wanted to speak to certain. We have a 18-year-old daughter and a 15-year-old son, and I just find, even like in Italian families, and we come from an Italian family, that how I just notice characteristics of how boys are brought up in Italian families and how the women are brought up, the girls are brought up. So I just see a lot of just correlations. I think my mother gave us a lot more freedom in that regard for some reason for my brother and I versus my two older sisters.
So what's your concern about your children?
Well, I just that they be a contribution to this thing called society, that they get the sense that there's an aspect of contribution. And my wife grew up very different than I did, and so it's that aspect of just them realizing that the house is a community and that everyone contributes to the community.
It's tough. What you're saying to me is they don't have that feeling.
Yeah, and I just look at somewhere my wife was certainly very young and very responsible and just whatever unfolded in her family. So I guess she had it in her background. I just don't want my children to be overly burdened with too much.
So she, Joe, do you have your radio on in the background?
Very low.
Just shut it off, would you?
Yes, sir. Well, hold on.
Sure.
Okay, I shut it off.
Better.
Okay.
So there's a disharmony between you and your wife.
Yes. Okay. Well, actually, yeah, because there has been that difference now. And when we're not on the same page, certainly we're not going to have the effectiveness that we would.
Yeah, so that's what you got to solve. I mean, that's the problem right there.
Yeah.
Somehow the two of you have to get on the same page, even if the page is different pages.
Yeah.
But it seems like it's at the moment it's kind of antagonistic.
Well, our daughter is going to school. She just went to her freshman year in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and it's just very interesting to see what has unfolded in a very short period of time with her being down there. There's a growth that's taken place. To be able to sit back as a parent and see, wow, the influence or lack of.
It's kind of amazing because
yeah.
It's one of the things we have in nature. Is that when the children leave the nest, they tend to balance out whatever we didn't provide. So if you're lucky like you are, you know, your daughter kind of picks up the pieces. But it's very hard to teach something like a sense of home, community. It's very hard to teach it. You can only demonstrate it. You can only show it, you know. And there has to be a harmony at home. If there's not harmony between you and your spouse, you can't really create a harmonious ideal in the house.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't.
Well, and there's certainly, I just see, just like a good farmer, you've got to be awake to what's in front of you. You've got to be, you can't produce that crop unless you make those distinctions along the way, be it weather, be it soil, be it when to seed, when to harvest. And the same thing with a child. If the parent is not whole, can you have a whole child?
Well, maybe not, but maybe whole children are not very existent, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe a whole child doesn't do the job, but, you know, give me a three-quarter child, I'll be happy.
Yeah, absolutely, sure.
Thanks for calling in, Joe.
Yeah, just that aspect of, I guess, what I'm speaking to being whole is just being that consciousness and awareness.
And kind,
yeah.
Kind. Thanks for calling in.
Well, and sometimes kind. And sometimes kindness may take a rough edge to it. I'm kind and giving. And sometimes my kindness shows up as a no.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's the boundaries that,
yeah, that
Stephanie
helps
was
know.
Talking about. Yes, it does help.
Yeah, I love you. I love my children. I adore them. And sometimes it's just a no. No, it's not. It's not going to go on. Something that just doesn't feel right. My intuition says it's just not.
Thank you for calling in, Joe.
Thank you, Warren.
Sure. Bye-bye. 212-209-2900. Child rearing, not an easy thing. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you?
Good.
Marissa here.
Hello, Marissa.
I'm a fraternal twin. to my brother, and I've always enjoyed being a twin. I felt like it was special.
Now, yeah, like, of course, Joe, right?
Me and Joe, right. Except now, like, after Octomom, she kind of ruined it for me.
Right.
Like, twins are nothing.
So she...
I have 8 kids, you know?
So you feel diminished, Marissa?
No, I'm just kidding.
I know.
But, you know, I had a very close relationship with my twin brother. We were the middle children, unfortunately, but I was an only girl, so that was a good position. I listened to your show on ranking.
Yes.
And we used to hold hands, and we went to every class together up until college. And then everything shifted. You know, like, we're not really together much, and we're so different. I speak to my brother a lot, but I don't really see him that much. We're so different today. It's weird.
You miss him.
I do. I miss my twin brother from then.
Yes, of course.
You know, he's too nervous now. You know, he has some health issues, and, you know, I pray for him, and I do whatever I can for him, but, like, He's very bright, though. Like, he knows what I'm going to say before I even, like, say it. He's very quick.
Hey, Marissa, when you were a kid, say about 10 years old, what game did you and your brother like to play the most?
Outdoor sports.
What game in particular? Basketball, baseball, football? What did you do?
Like, handball.
Handball, right? Now, does your brother still play handball?
No.
He's physically challenged? He can't do that?
No, I think he just dropped it. I continued on with exercise, dancing, and stuff like that, so I wouldn't lose it.
What about another game? What about a board game that you and he played?
We played a little chess.
You played a little chess?
Yes.
Do you and he ever play chess nowadays?
No.
You might do find something from childhood. Find a game that you played with him that wouldn't fit into his what he's incapable of doing nowadays, his challenges. Find a game, find a thing, whether it be Scrabble or something like that. Chess is kind of a little more difficult. Or even
I don't know if I even remember.
Yeah, see if you could find something in common that you both had and bring it to him one day and say,
okay,
let's play this together.
One.
You know, I think it'll make a real difference in giving you at least a piece of it, and he will enjoy himself.
Well, he was beaten down a lot by my eldest brother.
I hear.
And it's so, you know, and it's so unfair. My eldest brother, he ain't all that. He's basically not so great. But, you know, he was preferred over my twin, and I used to fight for my twin.
Mm.
But he never really backed me up when I fought for him.
I hear you.
It's kind of weird, you know?
Marissa,
it's
a fascinating history. I want to thank you for calling in. Thank you.
Welcome.
All right. 212-209-2900. Two sets of twins. Hi, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille.
Hello?
Hello there.
How you doing there, Armand?
Good.
I enjoy your show tremendously. It's always, always useful and interesting. I'm just curious about the effect that two parents have when they, on their children, in this case it was 5 children, where they're constantly comparing the children to each other, causing what seems, you know, what actually is competition, particularly the two oldest children, to the point where the two oldest children, my sister and myself, were childhood runaways. We started running away. I ran away from home starting at 13. And my sister followed at about 16. And as a result, I was the reason for her running away. And from that point forward, I was the rotten apple. My father used to say, one rotten apple will spoil the barrel. So as a result, I wasn't really welcomed home after about 16. And
what was that like?
Oh, it felt really bad. It felt like I was rejected. And
let me ask you something. When you made, what's your name, by the way?
I'm going to say Bob.
Bob, when you made that decision to break away from home, and you would come home, and your father would disown you because he had to. He had to make you a black sheep because he had the other kids to really control. He didn't have a way of loving you because you would have never run away if he did. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So when you came home, it hurt a lot, right?
Well, yeah. Every time I interact with them, I mean, our relationship has gotten somewhat better, but the pain is always there. Whenever I interact with my family, it's always there. And so it's very, very hard for me to... I try and avoid interacting with them.
Yeah, I understand.
And I isolate myself from them in particular. And I think it had a lot to do with my self-destructive behavior.
Sure.
From the time I started using hard drugs when I was about 14. I was very, I had high IQ, and I went to a very, very good school, and was usually a high achiever. But of course, when you're running away from home, you don't go to school very often.
Sure.
I dropped out, I think, in the 10th grade. I'd barely completed the 9th grade, but I took my diploma, GED test, when I was 16. Never finished college, but I went on to have a pretty decent career without college, because I can pick up things pretty quick. But now, my children, well, I've been drug-free for over 30 years. Is it 40 years? 1979, 1980. But it's very, very hard raising children when you're trying to destroy yourself. And I didn't get the same support with my children as my other brothers and sisters did. So I've always felt like an outcast. I've always felt that they treat me differently. And, of course, they deny it, but it's so obvious.
You know, it's going to take a while, Bob, at some point. At some point, you're not going to have to accept them. And you're not going to have to forgive them completely, but you're going to have to let them off the hook.
So do I, at any point, do I talk to them? And
nah, doesn't make a difference. When you get to be wise, sometimes you get wiser than the people, because they can't hear. And when they can't hear, but you know what the truth is, and you know this wasn't because you were a bad person, and you know because you were somebody who was just trying to survive,
mm-hmm.
that you did what you had to do, and it got you where you are, and mm-hmm. they weren't helpful, at some point, you don't forgive them and love them. You just say, I forgive them, but I can't love them, and that's okay.
Okay.
And sometimes that's the step that people have to make with their families. Sometimes you got to look at your family and you got to say, they're junk. They're not good. I can't really get the kind of love I want from them, nor can I give them the kind of love that they want. So I'm just going to have to accept that they're part of my blood family and that there's a certain thing that we could do with each other that's good, but that's as far as it goes. And some people, like you, are just basically orphans.
Mm-hmm. That's how I feel. That's exactly.
I understand.
Okay, thanks a lot, Alma.
Sure. 212-209-2900. We got time for one more caller. Hi, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille.
Hi, Armand. This is Meredith.
Hello, Meredith.
Hi, Stephanie. I know you from the DeMille Center as well.
Meredith. Hi, Meredith. How are you?
I'm great. I just this topic really struck a nerve for me, so I thought I could maybe contribute something by calling in. I'm adopted, and, you know, the nature versus nurture issue has always really resonated with me a lot. And so I just thought I'd give a call in and contribute that bit.
Well, tell me how you think it affects you.
Well, I don't know where to start, but basically it's a combination of both. I feel like genetically I discovered a lot about myself when I got into my adult years because I didn't meet my birth mother and then later on my birth father. But I'm a musician by trade, and I discovered in my freshman year at New England Conservatory of Music in Boston, I contacted my birth mother for the first time and found out that my birth grandmother had been a voice major at that school 40 years previous. So I always felt like, wow, that's, you know, that can't be an accident that I kind of found music in my genes. But having said that, I feel like the most important component has always been the upbringing that I had, which was wonderful. And ironically, I don't think I ever would have ended up at New England Conservatory of Music had it not been for the guidance of my adoptive parents who raised me.
Wow, fascinating, isn't it? Fascinating it that if we have a talent gene, it can be nurtured or it could be squelched.
Exactly.
And what you discovered was with the right kind of loving and freedom, you were able to take some part of yourself that's a talent and actually learn it. Because what I hear about you, Meredith, you're pretty fabulous in this world of music.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been a quest, and I'm really, this topic, I just feel like I have something to contribute to it. I've been doing a lot of writing about this existential issue, which I think for adoptees is extremely, extremely strong. And you do feel different, but what I've felt over the years is how, wow, it makes me special in a way that I can, I don't know, I can see things that maybe other people can't see about their own existence that, you know, when you grow up with parents that bore you, it's all wrapped up in the same package. And here you can kind of separate the, you know, the nature versus nurture, and it's just always been a fascinating topic for me.
Well, thank you, Meredith. Keep us, share with us the stuff that you've been learning. We'd like to learn more, too.
I will, absolutely. Thank you for your show. I love it.
Thank you for calling in. But, you know, not only Meredith, but Joe called when he first called in. He said, I'm a twin, and I feel different than everybody else. And Marissa called in, and she felt different than everybody else because she was a twin. And Bob called in, and he certainly felt different than everybody else. So there's got to be some place where people who feel different get a right to talk. And even Meredith, eh? Certainly different and talented. This is Armand DeBilt with you with The Positive Mind. This is a program for people who are different. Hey, we'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. We're going to be talking with a psychiatrist about some of the things that happen in a medical psychiatrist's office. You'd be surprised about it. Be sure to tune in. Back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends.
Gotcha.